everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. Today we are talking all about the movie Christine, which has some interesting differences from the book. But before we dive into that, I want to introduce you all to my new guest, Danny Ryan. Danny, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. And since it's your first time on the podcast, why don't you just go ahead and give us some quick background on you and your love for horror, apparently.
Yeah, I'm a big time horror fan. Have been since I was an early teenager. I'm a sort of a budding film critic writer on the internet. You can find me on Twitter at Danny Rat, DaniRat. I love horror. I love the fact that it forces us to face things that we're afraid of, because I think too many people run from their fears and we need to start facing them head on instead.
Even if some of them are supernatural cars.
Exactly. Even if it's a supernatural car, you gotta face it down.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, with Christine, this is something that's new for me. I hadn't watched this movie before watching it a week or two ago, I want to say, give or take. It's by the time everyone is listening to this, it'll be a little longer than that. But it was something that was my first time watching it. And I had just finished reading the book before doing that. I was like, all right, I have it. It's on Netflix too. So I'm just going to crank out the book and then I'll watch it, because I'm trying really hard, if it's not a movie I've already seen, to read the book first and then watch the adaptation, just because I feel like there's always so much in a Stephen King book that it's really interesting to see what was able to be translated to the film format.
Absolutely. Well, King is so, he goes off on a lot of tangents for good or bad.
Yes.
And so when you read one of his books, you always kind of, you know, wonder like, okay, which tangents are they going to include? Which side stories, which, you know, crazy rants are they going to put in the film version? It's like, there's recently been news that they're doing The Stand, and it's just so, that one's so long and crazy. I'm like, it has to be a TV show or miniseries. There's no way. And with Christine, I mean, there's a ton of side plots. There's a lot of extra stuff that's just completely cut out from the film. So I would say, yeah, it is a good idea to read the books first with Stephen King, pretty much always.
Yeah, that wasn't necessarily the case. I've seen the It miniseries and the first It remake, and I have not dived into that book yet, but that was something I watched before I decided to do this podcast and sort of go back and go through all of his work chronologically, which helps a lot with the whole reading the book before watching the movie thing in my case. But with Christine, do you remember when you first watched the movie?
So I have an aunt who is also named Christine and who is a huge Stephen King fan. And I remember watching it with her. And I want to say my younger brother. And I remember that night my younger brother had to sleep in my room with me because he was so afraid the car was going to get him. And I made fun of him because we were on the second story. And I was like, car can't fly. Like, it can definitely get through a house, but it cannot fly. So we must have been like 10 and 12. So I was probably about 12 years old the first time I saw this. And it's always left certain images in my head that are just never going to go away.
Yeah, obviously with me being much older when I watched it, it wasn't quite as terrifying, but it did have some really great moments in it. But before we dive into the plot and what was different from the book and everything, I do want to talk about the casting, because I didn't know a lot of the names. And I would say Harry Dean Stanton is probably the most well-known name to me anyway in this movie. Otherwise, I was looking and it was either a bunch of people who didn't end up doing a whole lot after, or, you know, I believe one of the ladies was from Baywatch at some point down the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty much the only ones I know are like John Stockwell was in Top Gun, and Kelly Preston, who she was in a bunch of different things. But those are the only two that I sort of remember besides Harry Dean Stanton. And on my rewatch, he was the one that I got really excited. I was like, oh yeah, I forgot Harry Dean Stanton was in this. Yes! Like, anytime he shows up, it's an automatic plus 10 points for a movie.
Yeah, it's funny. I had just watched something else that he was in. I believe it was some HBO movie, probably. And it wasn't all that great. But I was like, oh, this face is very familiar because I literally just watched something with him in it. But like you said, some of the people did quite a few things, but I've found that with some of these older adaptations of Stephen King's books, some of the actors just didn't really do much after this. You know, with The Shining, the kid who plays Danny, it's like, that's kind of what he's known for. Same with the two girls who played the Grady twins. That's sort of all they've been known for pretty much their entire lives. So it's interesting when you have that happen, especially when there are parts of the roles that are just played so well by these people. And I was very surprised with how much I enjoyed this, because I was totally expecting it to be way cheesier than it was, even though, you know, it was a John Carpenter movie. I should have had higher expectations going into it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, when you hear it's a killer car movie, you're like, okay, that's, how could I possibly take any of that seriously? But Carpenter really, really understood the tone for this film. And he didn't go, you know, really into the horror comedy like American Werewolf in London type thing. He really didn't cheese it up. And he took it as seriously as possible. And it works because of that. And I think the performances really reflect that, because most of the actors give it a dramatic, like a truly dramatic performance. And they, you can tell they believe in, you know, their characters and what their characters are feeling, which, it's a killer car movie. So that's kind of unusual, but it's cool.
Yeah, I know too that Keith Gordon, who played Arnie, sort of went in a different direction after this. He ended up doing more directing, I believe. And so he still stayed within the film industry in some respect, but it seems like his acting sort of wasn't the focus going forward. And I think that's also something that's cool to see, how maybe someone's experience on a movie can lead them to a different section of the film industry going forward.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's one of the coolest things about cinema, is that it takes so many people to make these things, to make film, that if you get in and you're, you know, a boom mic operator or a best boy or an actor or whatever, and then you go, oh, wow, I really want to direct, or I want to produce, or I really want to be in production design or whatever, there's always opportunities to try different things within the industry and to do different types of creative expression, which is just, it's great. And I love that Carpenter does that too. I mean, he's a musician, you know, he does an amazing score for this movie. And he's a director and he's a writer and also a video game fanatic, apparently. So film allows you to sort of explore all avenues of your creativity.
Absolutely. Plus, with Arnie, Dennis, and Lee in this, I think that core group of characters, they did a very nice job casting them. You really felt like their performances were how teenagers would react in this sort of situation. And to be able to see that come to life on the screen instead of just reading about it in a book is obviously much different. You know, in the book, Stephen King gives you so much detail that you can see Arnie changing throughout it. But I think actually seeing that happen in the movie is just so stunning, because you see how his wardrobe has changed. And I read that Keith Gordon actually had a lot to do with the wardrobe choices for Arnie. So that's something that's really cool, where you have this trust with these actors that you've cast and you sort of let them just add their own little element to it.
I saw the same thing where he said he was really into the idea of the costumes reflecting the era that Christine was from. So his costumes, his outfits get more and more 1950s as they go. And eventually he's basically dressed as James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause, which is just great. And yeah, that's, it's amazing. And not only do his, you know, his outfits change, but I feel like his posture changes, the way he carries himself, even the way he talks, his way of speaking completely changes as he goes from this shy, nerdy, sort of repressed guy to this possessed guy who thinks he's a badass. And it's kind of an interesting transformation to watch from all aspects.
Absolutely. Why don't we go ahead and dive a little more into the plot? Because I think there's a lot to discuss as far as the differences go from the book, because things happen in a different order than they do in the book. And they take out some characters and replace them with characters that were still in the book, but didn't have the same kind of role necessarily. And I think one of the most important things is that I was under the impression in the book that Lee shows up after Arnie has already bought the car. And in this, it's flipped. So we see her as the new girl in school, and everyone sort of has this fascination with her. And then Arnie gets the car, and that's when sort of things, I think, speed up a little for the movie, too. You know, I thought this was pretty nicely paced in comparison to the book.
Absolutely. And they also made sure they gave Christine more of an origin story, a different origin story that was a little bit more visual, because the original origin story was much more metaphorical or esoteric. So they had to do something that was, you know, a good scare. And yeah, so let's dive in. The biggest thing for me is definitely the origin story of the car.
Yes.
Because in the film, the car's evil from day one. It rolls off the assembly line and kills it and takes a dude's hand off. It's just, you know, it's just an evil car. Whereas in the novel, the car is a totally normal car that becomes possessed by its former owner. And there's little hints of that sort of peppered throughout the film when they talk about LeBay, the character of LeBay, and how his wife killed herself in the car and his daughter died in the car and all these different things. And so he went crazy and became obsessed with the car. And it was, you know, so it definitely gave that little bit of backstory, but it didn't frame it out as like, that's why the car is evil. It was instead the car was evil from the get-go and it made this man go crazy.
Yeah, and you have the big difference of which LeBay brother sells Arnie the car.
Yeah, which is kind of weird. Like, why switch that?
Yeah, that did feel weird. I didn't mind changing up the origin story quite as much as I was like, but where is he? Why are we only getting the brother?
Right, and it's because he's dead.
Which happens in the book, but later on, he sells the car and then dies. And I think that's kind of a more interesting story, almost like he couldn't live without the car.
Right. That is actually, it's a little more interesting. The idea that, oh, he sold Christine and now that's it. He can't survive without her. Whereas in the book, or I mean, in the movie, he's already dead. So it doesn't matter. It's just gone.
Yeah.
But I guess you could make the case that maybe Carpenter and company wanted to go with the idea that, like, maybe his soul possessed the car or something, and that's why he was dead. I'm not sure. But I definitely feel like that was kind of a weird switch.
One thing I did notice, too, because you mentioned being so excited about Harry Dean Stanton being in this, we get a lot less of Detective Junkins in the movie than we do in the book.
I noticed that there's a lot of deleted scenes that were left on the cutting room floor. Right. If you go on IMDb and look at the trivia, like half of it is just the deleted scenes. Good God. And so I kind of wonder if more of that was sort of left on the floor, because the movie does sort of get a little bogged down in its back half. I feel like, and that's where Detective Junkins shows up, and so it already feels like there's too much going on, and then they add that plot line too. So maybe they did that for time reasons or to streamline it more, but I would have liked to see a lot more of Harry Dean Stanton, because he's great in this, and the dynamic between him and Keith Gordon as Arnie is just great. The way that Arnie sasses him about, you know, is it illegal to fix your own car? And when Harry Dean Stanton's just very matter of fact, no, never has been. It's great. It's really good stuff.
Yeah, to focus on Lee a little here real quick,
yeah,
you have her going out with Arnie. And that's why she basically tells Dennis she can't go out with him. But then the two of them end up together somewhat in the end. And the end of the movie doesn't give us the same ending as the book, because Stephen King loves himself some epilogues. And I think I actually kind of enjoyed some of what they did with the Dennis and Lee relationship a little better in the movie, because we didn't need to get too much more context that was given to us in the book. It's like, okay, it's obvious that these two would sort of be teaming up together to try and help Arnie, even if, you know, Arnie and Lee's relationship might be past fixing because of her still choking in the car, which I'm very glad they kept that scene in.
Yeah, that scene is so unsettling. Her choking in the car and the bright, bright inside lights and all of that is just so unsettling. And her reaction is, it's great acting. I mean, she's really seems like she's genuinely afraid of the car, which is a sort of a difficult thing to pull off.
Absolutely. And you can tell that Arnie is super defensive of Lee, but at the same time, he's being completely irrational in that moment because he decides that he's going to be upset with the guy who saves Lee. And it's like, okay, you tried one door on the car and it was locked. You didn't think to go around to the other door?
Or to break the window? Like, right. Obviously this car is more important to you than human life, which is your major problem. I mean, and not only human life, but this girl you're on a date with, of all things. Like, that's awful.
And I think Keith Gordon played that part so well in that moment, too. I was really impressed with his performance throughout. And when I was going back through IMDb and I was like, oh, okay, he went in the director mode after this. It kind of made sense to me because he seemed to have a very good vision of the character Arnie was supposed to be, even though obviously being under the direction of John Carpenter is never a bad thing either.
No, definitely not. You could do much, much worse.
Yeah, so let's talk about Christine, because obviously, name of the book, name of the movie, very important part.
Name of the car, yep.
Yeah, I think with the movie, they put a lot more focus on just us visually getting all of these different looks at the car. And they used so many cars for this. So many cars. I think it was around 15 cars that they had for this movie.
It's something like that. They crashed all but two. 15 that they crashed. That's what it is. Because there's two survivor cars that I know, because there's two that are in private collections. So that's it. There's only two that survived. And one of them, the entire front is made of rubber, which is kind of interesting. So it's not even really a fully functioning car.
Right.
But they did, they made, 17 of these cars, and it's funny because the 1957 Plymouth Fury had a very specific look to it and was kind of a rare car at this point, so they had to use some other cars that were similar and really just modify them to look like the Plymouth Fury, of that year, and they really had to tweak that, so they actually used a variety of cars, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like they used a lot of 58 Plymouth Furies, and it says the 17 cars were reassembled from 24 different models of the 58 Plymouth Fury, and this 15 facts about John Carpenter's Christine article that I came across when I was looking into what exactly they did with these cars. And it's actually a pretty good list, so I'll link to it in the show notes, but they just have a lot of interesting facts about the car, because I know one moment that you put down that you want to talk about is the car rebuilding itself. So yes. Basically what they did was they had a bunch of hydraulics and sort of played the footage backwards. So they filmed the car being destroyed. You're seeing it played backwards, so it looks like it's being rebuilt.
Yeah, it's really cool that because they used hydraulics basically on the inside of the car to pull it in on itself so that it basically crushed from the inside. And then play that in reverse. So you see metal, you know, popping out and back into place. And you see it fixing itself in a way that it's very, very tactile. Like, you can almost feel it the way that it's portrayed in the film. And the sound effects are perfect. And it's one of the coolest practical effects that I've seen that's not a gore effect. Because usually in these kind of movies, you know, you're looking for, oh, I want to see somebody get their head cut off, or I want to see some really nasty gore. This is not a particularly gory movie in any way.
No.
In fact, it almost got a PG rating, and they added in the F word a couple of times in order to get an R, because they were worried that a PG horror movie wouldn't do well. And this was before PG-13.
Yeah.
But yeah, that car effect is just excellent. And I feel like they really, really utilized it well, both the first time you see it after some of the guys at his school decide that they're going to take out the car, you know, they're going to destroy what he loves. And so they smash it all up with bats and all that kind of thing. And Christine rebuilds herself. And then later in the movie, after... Do we talk spoilers or?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. After Arnie is gone, after Arnie is dead, his friends, you know, he then Lee and Dennis go to get rid of Christine, you know, to both exact revenge for Arnie and to, you know, get rid of this evil freaking car. And even as they're attacking it with a bulldozer, the car starts rebuilding itself and the radio comes back on. And there's something just ultimately horrifying about the idea of something you cannot kill.
Yeah. And even when they do manage to get the car to a junkyard and have it impounded, and it's just this block of metal, you see one thing move on it at the end. And you're like, oh boy, here we go again, even though the characters don't know it yet. And I was a little disappointed that he didn't have the, what was it, a giant purplish pink sewer mobile?
Yeah. Well, because King imagined it as this battle between two women, this sort of like badass finale where these two female cars fought each other, which is getting into some weird fetish stuff, if you ask me. But it's really interesting. Yeah, it was like a pink just junker van thing, and instead they went with a bulldozer, which, you know, that is a little bit more visually interesting, I think, and we get to see a lot more crushing and twisting of metal. So it's probably just a Hollywood upgrade.
It makes way more sense from a practical standpoint, but part of me was still expecting the one from the book to be the vehicle. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes way more sense. So,
absolutely.
I think, too, because they didn't add in the epilogue of the car then attacking the last man standing, basically, in California, you're sort of just left with, okay, clearly the car is going to come back. And it's almost as if they left it to where they could do a sequel if they really wanted to. Not that I'm saying there needs to be a Christine sequel, but it felt like they were like, okay, you know, we're going to have it move just a little at the end.
Absolutely.
And then we'll see what happens next.
Well, and I feel like that's kind of a horror trope I want to say kind of started in the 80s with the idea of that you cannot kill this thing. You cannot get rid of it. And I think Carpenter has a lot to do with that because, you know, he made Michael Myers Unkillable and he really took that direction with it. And then you've got the Friday the 13th movies and you've got Nightmare on Elm Street. And so when it came to these monsters, there had to be something at the end that sort of left you a little bit squeamish or a little bit scared. And I think Christine did the same thing where it's just kind of like, oh, wait, she might still be alive. And, you know, it works. It's a fun ending. And I think that's what's important is especially with this type of Stephen King movie is that it's kind of fun.
Yeah. A lot of the differences they have from the book too are mostly for practical reasons, it seems. You know, in the book, Christine is at the airport long-term parking lot, and that's where she's wrecked. But then here, it happens in Darnell's garage because, you know, they probably only had X amount of money and weren't going to go find a parking lot to destroy Christine in when they already had this ginormous garage available to them. So, you know, that and the bulldozer being the vehicle they use instead, it was mostly, at least it seemed to me, for practical reasons. And I understood a lot of the changes they made. I think the LeBay thing was probably the one I understood the least. I was like, you couldn't pay one person to show up? Just one more?
Right, just one more actor? That's it? I mean, shoot, you even could have had a cameo. You could have just, you know, had somebody that was already on set stand in and just do this little cameo role and it wouldn't have been no big thing. So
you could have had Stephen King do it.
Exactly. That would have been great.
And, you know, he's the one who actually pitched the movie being made, because when I was going through and, you know, planning out this podcast and everything, I was like, wow, Christine was adapted very quickly in comparison to when the book came out, you know, so you have them happening in the same year.
Yeah.
1983 was a very busy Stephen King year. You have Christine, Cycle of the Werewolf, Cujo, Pet Sematary, The Dead Zone, and Christine in, you know, movie and novel form. So you're having all of these things happen. And it turns out he actually pitched it while he was, you know, in like the editing process or something like that. And I think that's actually a really interesting way to find out how this movie happened so quickly, because you're like, that is not nearly enough time to film a movie, even in the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things that very, very rarely happens, where they shoot the movie and release the novel sort of coincide. The only other time I can think that it's happened was the Hannibal Rising, because Thomas Harris's Hannibal stuff, you know, has always had a built-in audience. So they're like, oh, we'll just make the movie. It's fine. Because the book came out like a month before the movie. I was like, how did this happen?
Yeah.
and Christine, it was kind of the same thing, is they knew they could bank on Stephen King, that people, they had butts in seats. You say Stephen King and people will be there. And especially in 1983. So, you know, it's kind of cool that that's the way it happened. And I'm not upset about all of the great Stephen King stuff we got, even the stuff that's not so great. Like,
right.
We've got tons of it. And that's what's so fun.
What amazes me is the fact that that still holds credence today. You could say a Stephen King movie is coming to theaters, like, you know, Pet Sematary is coming soon, for instance. And even though it's a remake, a lot of people are going to go see that movie. And I think it's kind of happening in not quite this sweet spot between superhero movies, because it's coming the same weekend as Shazam. But I think horror fans in particular are a group of people who will sort of go out for any big horror movie. If it's, you know, something related to Halloween, Friday the 13th, anything Stephen King, you can guarantee that those fans are going to be there, because over the years, they've just built up such a cult following, whether it's those franchises or just Stephen King as a writer in general.
Well, and Stephen King appeals to more than just horror fans too, which is, yes, I think, what's so great about him, because, you know, my dad loves Stephen King. My dad's a huge Stephen King fan, and my dad hates horror, like thinks it's, you know, a dirty word practically. He just cannot do horror movies. But he loves Stephen King, and you know, my mom's read some Stephen King. She loves Stephen King movies. My aunt, all of these are folks who normally you would never get to watch, you know, a horror movie. Like, I have to beg and beg and beg for them to watch something. Like I'm still trying to get them to watch Get Out. And yet they will watch a Stephen King movie without a moment's hesitation, because they love Stephen King and they love his version of Americana, and they love his sort of outlook on the world and his way of writing characters. And I think there's something that really connects with that generation and Stephen King. And I think he's sort of tapped into that in a way that we maybe don't entirely understand, as the younger generation who grew up with him. But before him, there wasn't really anybody quite like that.
Yeah. What do you think of the decision to also have us see a lot less of the parents? You know, we don't see Dennis talking to Arnie's dad quite as much as we do in the book. And I think, you know, at the end there, when it was Arnie who was in the car, I believe in the book, it was the dad who was either in the trunk of the car or something to that effect. But the dad was in the car and he was the one who was already dead. So I think, you know, the decision to focus on the teens more does change a good chunk of the story in a sense.
It does, but I'm kind of glad that they chose to focus on the teens more, because it's more Arnie's story than yes. anything. And I feel like, and actually in the movie, the stuff between him and his parents, I kind of rolled my eyes at, because it's this, you're so controlling, you never let me do what I want, kind of like regular teen angst stuff. And I'm like, there's enough of this in the 80s. I don't need to watch any more of this. So when the parents sort of took a backseat and the friends became more important to the central narrative, I was like, okay, good. So I'm actually glad of that decision, because I think there's enough my parents don't understand me teen angst drama out there for everybody.
Yeah. Another change that I liked was that Dennis was sidelined, but it felt much longer in the book. It felt much more drawn out. And here you have him sort of coming back, I don't know, maybe like 20, 30 minutes later. It's like, okay, all this time has passed. He's back at home.
Yeah, yeah. Just do the magic of movie time.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, even though we don't get as many scenes with Dennis at the hospital, you know, his family coming to visit, Arnie coming to visit, we do get enough of it. You know, we get that one scene with him and Arnie in the hospital, and Dennis can tell that something is off. But in the book, I felt Dennis being sidelined was actually a downside, because Dennis was sort of the one at least somewhat keeping Arnie under control. And then when he was injured, it's like Arnie just completely went off the rails. And even though that still happens, it seems like, you know, it wasn't as bad necessarily as it was in the book, because you're like, okay, come on, when's Dennis coming back? When's Dennis coming back? And you sort of almost get a little tired of Arnie's perspective, but you never really get tired of it in the movie. And I like that, like you said, they focus more on the three teens and sort of everything that's going on with them. So I felt like there wasn't as much downtime where, you know, Lee doesn't want to see Arnie, and then Lee is teaming up with Dennis to try and fix things.
Right. And I feel like the stuff they do with Dennis is really good in the film. Arnie showing up on Thanksgiving with a six pack of beer and being like, hey, here's your Thanksgiving beer. And I'm like, this kid's 17. Like, how did he get this beer? And, you know, he's just turned into a total bad boy. And Arnie can't do anything about it. He's laying there in bed like, dude, listen to me. This is not what's wrong. What's going on? And Arnie just leaves. And I feel like those little moments are really good character development. And I would have liked to see a little bit more Dennis, just because I feel like that character and that performance are both so great.
Yeah.
But not overall disappointed that they decided to focus on Arnie, because again, it's his story.
I love how well Dennis gets across the point that he is very wary of the car, you know, because he's still on crutches and everything. And you can tell he doesn't want to get in the car, but for Arnie's sake, he's going to.
Right, right. You know, you're my friend, so I'll do this thing, but I don't want to. And well, and Lee, too, you know, I'm never getting in that car again. And she, and even before she, you know, is nearly killed by the car, she is really uncomfortable with the way that Arnie acts towards the car. And he even says, girls usually get jealous of other girls, not cars. And she's like, well, this car is a girl. And there's sort of like a weird sexual thing between Arnie and the car almost. Yeah. Like, it's weird. There's a fetishization that goes on that clearly he's become obsessed with this car to a point that it is sexualized. And Lee sees that, and she's like, this is your girlfriend, man. And even he gets mad, you know, when Harry Dean Stanton's like, I talked to your girlfriend, she was, you know, much more believable than you. And he's like, she's not my girlfriend. And I'm like, oh, you worried Christine's gonna get jealous? Is that what this is about?
Yeah, plus you have the fact that Lee is way more adamant about staying away from the car than Dennis is. You know, Dennis is trying to ease Arnie into the idea that the problem could be the car, whereas Lee is just flat out not wanting to have anything to do with it. She's very opinionated about the car, and with good reason, too. But I think another thing I noticed was Dennis really seemed like the only stand-up guy in this movie, and even possibly in the book, even though I think with the parents having more of an involvement in the book, you know, like Arnie's dad didn't seem too horrible, but we didn't see enough of him in this to really sort of make that judgment call. But you know, between all of the teenagers we see, it's like Dennis is the only one who's decent.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I during my rewatch, I texted my husband. I forgot how much I hate all these kids and Christine. I was like, I just, oh, these guys, especially, they're gross. They say lots of really nasty sexist stuff. They clearly don't respect women. They don't respect each other. Like, they're bad kids or bad teenagers. And there's definitely sort of a, you know, there's sort of a thread that goes through this with, these are not good people. And I feel like Dennis and Lee are kind of the only two that stand out as maybe being decent human beings in this film. And that's why I'm glad they survive. Like, I'm really glad that they're sort of our final girl and boy in this, because Arnie doesn't deserve it.
Not at all. No. Buddy Repperton in particular, too, is just so obnoxious. And I'm kind of glad we didn't get quite as much of him as I think we do in the book either, because I don't know if I would have been able to take it. And it's one of those things where this movie came out the same year as the book in 1983. So you have to factor in the setting in 1983 when Stephen King wrote this book, when the movie was made. And it's definitely going to be interesting to see how these adaptations evolve over the years, just because of how times have changed between now and then. So to me, it's like, I'm always keeping that in consideration based on, you know, some of the things the characters say and do, because it's like, okay, you know, yes, I'm watching this in 2019, but I can't have the expectation that it would look like something from 2019.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have to go in, you know, watching things with in mind what the time is. You know, it's blowing up today. People are like, Blazing Saddles couldn't get made today. And I'm like, shut up. That's not even an argument. Like, we have to look at movies in the time that they exist in, because that's it's just the way it is, you know. And with Christine, you know, getting upset or offended because of some of the things these characters say would be kind of silly, because what it's doing is telling us that they're bad characters. It's just doing it in a very 1983 way, which might be a little unwoke or un-PC, but it is what it is, and it was right for the time.
Plus, they're teenagers. Teenagers, even today, still say dumb things. It's like, that's not ever going to change, really. And I think, yeah, obviously, some teens are having a lot more of a conversation around these things, especially as we've seen more tragedies happen. But the tragedies that happen in Christine are completely different, because they're happening to literally the worst people. So it's one of those things where it's like, you know, I don't like Christine, but I don't blame Christine either.
Yeah, she's a very understandable villain. You're kind of like, you know what, if you wanna squish Buddy like a little, you know, like a frog or a bug, go for it. Like, I'm not really too upset about it. You almost root for Christine a little bit in certain places, and I think that's intentional. You know, with the bad to the bone being her soundtrack, like, that's, it's kind of cool. And there's nothing in this world as cool as her driving out of that garage on fire, just, you know, this crazy red Plymouth on totally aflame, just driving down the street. It's crazy. It's nuts. And it's fun. And it's cool. It's cool in a way that makes us kind of like the car, even though we don't necessarily condone what she's doing.
One thing I did really enjoy, too, was Will Darnell's expression on his face when he saw the car come in and didn't see anyone ever get out of it. He was like, okay, yes, come on. And like, who's going to come out? And it's like, no one. No one at all.
Yeah, he's like, all right, come out. I know you're in there. And he opens the door and there's nobody there. And the reveal is really great, because you see him open the door and we see his face, but they don't show us inside the car until after we've seen his reaction. So it's really good. Carpenter knows how to focus on the human elements of horror. And in this case, it's the very human reaction to, oh my God, this car drove itself. Like, that's insane. And so he has a very understandable reaction. He's terrified. And so we get to see that. And that's great. Instead of us knowing the whole time Christine was driving herself, she's got, you know, tinted windows. You can't tell. And up until he opens that door, I mean, you kind of assume that Arnie is behind the wheel.
I think with Darnell, too, he might have realized that, you know, I don't think this can be Arnie, but maybe he gave the keys to someone else. Because I believe at the time, Arnie is on a run for Will Darnell. And it's not quite the time he comes back and has to confront Junkins and everything. But I do think it's something along those lines. So I think that adds to the element of surprise for him.
Absolutely, because he's like, this is impossible. And then he finds out that it's even more impossible than he thought.
Absolutely. And he keeps his mouth shut about it, too. He's not going around telling anyone, because he's like, you know, I might sound crazy if I do this.
Right. I mean, I would not know what to do. I mean, if you go around telling people the car is driving itself, people are going to be like, okay, you off your meds? What are you doing? Exactly. And unfortunately, you know, that's kind of what happens in this case. And then eventually, you know, our heroes, Lee and Dennis, figure out, this car is evil, man. We got to get rid of the car. And they believe in it. And thankfully, since they've both experienced what it can do, they have that shared understanding, and they're able to defeat it. Mostly defeat it together.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to discuss with the plot before we talk a little bit more in depth about the soundtrack?
No, I think that's it. I think the soundtrack is for sure the next thing to talk about, because it's great.
Very 80s and very good for the 80s, in my opinion. You already mentioned the theme song for Christine being Bad to the Bone. And one of the things with the book, too, is that you get these little clips of song lyrics at the beginning of each chapter or each section. I'm not really sure which. Sometimes the books are divided a little differently depending on what copies you have, but you get a lot of song lyrics in the book. And I think they did a pretty nice job of sort of adapting that style of music and that sense of music to the movie, because you have some very big names on the soundtrack. You know, Buddy Holly and the Crickets are on it as well, Little Richard, Bonnie Raitt, and Tanya Tucker, which maybe not quite as fitting as the rest of the songs because they're sort of, you know, these big country artists. And even though it's fitting for the time, it's like, oh, okay, you're going to throw a little wrench in this soundtrack here.
Yeah, and ABBA, like they're, yeah. it's definitely kind of a weird mix, but it also works because it's the idea of like what would have been on the radio. And
yeah.
And there's also a good mix of 50s music in there, too, with, like, Buddy Holly, Little Richard.
Which makes sense, given the
Richie
car.
Richie Valens.
Yeah.
Right, because the car is from the 50s. So it absolutely makes sense that there would be this sort of 50s music. And as, you know, Arnie starts dressing like, you know, like James Dean, and he's starting to get more 50s, that sort of, the music does sort of get a little more 50s as it goes, too. It goes from more contemporary 80s stuff to, like ABBA, to the more 50s kind of stuff. My favorite moment musically is definitely Rolling Stones' Beast of Burden. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's just a really great little clip of music in it. And I feel like the score is also excellent, although there is one part where it sounds almost like the Halloween score. Like it's it's like one note off. And I'm like, I see you, John Carpenter. But it's still great. I mean, it still sounds great. It's still creepy. And it's still Carpenter. So you can't be upset about it.
Absolutely. I think, too, with the soundtrack, you know, even though something might have come out in the 50s, that doesn't mean it's not still going to be popular. There are plenty of people who still listen to 80s music today, you know, because it's just dependent on what generation you grew up in. So, you know, my parents listened to 80s music. That's sort of how I found out about a lot of 80s music. And while it's not something I necessarily go and listen to every single day, it's something I was familiar with enough to know a good chunk of these songs. And even if I didn't necessarily know the artist or the name of the song, it's like, yes, I have heard this. I am familiar.
Yes, I have heard this before, be it in another movie or a commercial or something, because these are all kind of 80s classics or 50s classics. I mean, especially like the Little Richard, you know, Keep a Knockin'. Like it's one of those, I'm like, I couldn't have told you that was Little Richard, and I couldn't have told you the name of the song, but I could have told you I knew it. And it's that same sort of thing. And I think it would be interesting if they ever did, you know, a reimagining of this, or they ever did a sequel or whatever, to do an update and to do it, you know, modern or whatever, and then have it be an 80s car. Have it be a Firebird from the 80s, an 83 Firebird. And have the person start dressing more 80s. Have the music start going more 80s. Have it go that way. But it's just such a neat little time capsule of both the 1980s and sort of the reverence that we've always had for the 1950s.
Yeah, I really like how you mentioned they sprinkle in those 50s songs. It's almost like Christine is trying to keep the 50s alive all on her own.
Right, yeah. She is the 50s. You cannot kill her because she is the 50s. Very much so. And she sort of infects people with the stuff from the 50s. It's sort of like time not letting you move forward or not letting you go on.
I do want to note that even though they had to make some modifications and reassemble the car from a bunch of 1958 Plymouth Furies, I really love the look of the car. You know, it's like this giant boat car. It's massive, and it just stands out so much because of that red and white paint job.
Oh, it's gorgeous. My dad and I actually build model cars sometimes, and that was when we'd always wanted to do, because it is just a gorgeous looking car. And that's why I recommended, if they did an 80s version, do a Firebird, because that's like, that's such a, you know, visually interesting car. Same sort of thing. It's an 80s muscle car versus a 50s muscle car. But it's a great looking car. That red, that shade of red, is just perfect, because it didn't come in that color. The car actually only came in like a tan, like a beigey tan, right. A 57 did. So it was a completely custom color, and it's this, it's not blood red, but it's just slightly brighter. It's almost like Dario Argento red.
As someone who really, really loves red, I was just very impressed with the color and how much it popped on the screen, even in the 80s.
Yeah, it's a really, really cool shade. I need lipstick in that shade. Like, that is a perfect shade of red for cars, for anything. It's just, it's not too orangey, so the flames don't look goofy with it. It's got just enough blue in it to give it some depth. So you got me going to color theory now.
It helps, too, though, that a lot of the movie was dark. Too, you know, Christine comes out at night and still stands out against the night light and everything like that. And yes, there are daytime scenes, but for the most part, you know, Dennis drives a car that's a much darker color. And a lot of the cars seem to either be darker colors or more neutral colors. So Christine just sort of stood out no matter what scene the car was in.
Yeah, whether she's in the garage or at the school parked next to all the other cars. And he parked like a total jerk, too. He took up like 3 spaces. Like, I noticed that this on this watch. I was like, dude, really got to park like that? You know, she does. The car stands out because it's this red and white and the silver trim and just all of it is so visually interesting, and the other cars are so dull that, yeah, of course it's going to stick out to your eye, and it's a really cool visual, and there's something kind of scary about it just because it is so red. You know, we associate red generally with either love or blood. And so it's kind of like, oh, okay. Well, and sex too. So there's a lot of studies about the color red, and so it's a really cool decision that they made to go with that red and to go with that particular car and the way that they did it. And it's gorgeous. And now I really want to build that model.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I imagine that would be a really cool one to have. Are there any final thoughts you have on the movie? I know for me, I actually believe I rated this a 4 out of 5 just because I enjoyed watching it so much more than I was expecting. And like I said, maybe knowing that it was a John Carpenter movie, I should have had some higher expectations. But, you know, the movie definitely delivered, even though it was different than maybe what I was expecting having just read the book.
Absolutely. It's one that I had always sort of remembered from my childhood and watching it, you know, as a kid and with my brother and those kinds of things. And so to go back as an adult and watch it was definitely a different experience, but I still enjoyed it. And I still thought that a lot of it really, really works. And it almost shouldn't because it's so silly. It's killer car, but it works. And I attest that to both, you know, Stephen King's writing and understanding of human nature and making it actually really a story about a man who chooses, you know, this inanimate object and this identity over the people in his life, instead of, you know, just a random killer car thing that, you know, has no real emotional impact. And John Carpenter, because the dude can direct pretty much anything and make it good. So this is one of the better Stephen King adaptations, in my opinion. And it's one that I'll always, always go back to and enjoy.
Again, especially for it being the 80s. And I'm finding that there are a lot of movies that are older. And I find if they use practical effects, they age so much better. There are some you watch them and you're just like, oh, clearly this was a TV movie and didn't have as much of a budget because it doesn't look all that great these days.
Oh, there are some where you're just like, oh, wow, this is when we thought CGI could do everything and we didn't know better yet. I love practical effects. I've always loved special effects and practical special effects, whether it's, you know, makeup or it's the car, you know, reassembling itself. And it's funny because the car reassembling itself reminds me of the American Werewolf in London transformation scene, because it's the same sort of thing. It's a building out in reverse shot. Yeah. And it's just really, really good work. And I don't think this movie gets quite enough credit for being as good as it is, given the premise.
I agree. And I think that's a very good note to end this episode on. So, Danny, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this. It was definitely one I was looking forward to. As soon as I watched it, I was like, oh, yes, I have thoughts.
Yes, yes. I was super excited when I went to sign up to do a podcast with you and I saw Christine. I was like, oh, I remember my brother being upset, even though we were on the second floor. I got to do that one. So it's good to be on here. And thank you for having me.
Of course. And we'll link to your Twitter and everything in the show notes so everyone can find you. And the podcast is available on Apple, Google, YouTube. You can listen to it in a lot of different places. And we're on Twitter at Chat Cemetery, as well as Instagram. Same handle. So nice and easy there. But to our listeners, as always, thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.